Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it is September 22nd. We're going to finish up metabolism and move on to nervous system today. So on the screen, I've got a slide of cellular respiration that you should be familiar with. So always think of everything that we're talking about, the glycolysis, the anaerobic pathway, Krebs cycle, preparatory reactions, electron transport, even beta oxidation, which we're going to talk to today, as cellular respiration. And know what parts of the cell these things take place in. All right, so where does glycolysis take place? You see it happening in the cytosol, right? And then pyruvic acid has two fates. Under anaerobic conditions, it gets converted into lactic acid, thereby preserving glycolysis so that some ATP can be made. Otherwise, pyruvic acid enters the mitochondria. It undergoes a preparatory reaction where it's decarboxylated, and an acetyl group then is donated to the Krebs cycle. And then high-energy electrons produced by the Krebs cycle enter electron transport chain, and that's where we left off last time. And it's the electron transport chain within the inner wall of the mitochondria that produced the bulk of ATP for our bodies. All right, so we looked at anaerobic respiration and aerobic respiration right here. So what's the whole point of cellular respiration? Yeah, just to make ATP and to make a lot of ATP, right, so that we can do a lot of things. So you do have to know some complicating factors like coenzymes. Give me a name of a coenzyme. NAD, FADH. As a matter of fact, I suppose you could even think of ATP as being a coenzyme. A coenzyme is just a big organic molecule that carries something from one set of reactions to another. And what ATP is carrying from one set of reactions to another sometimes is a phosphate group, but in every case it's carrying energy, right? And energy is just as real a substance as matter is. So I like to think of ATP as really being a coenzyme as well. All right, so let's see. Here we are looking at electron transport chain. So what is flowing through all of these different chemicals? Let me get my arrow going right here. So what's flowing through all these different chemicals? And here we can see it's a plot of free energy. All right, so this reaction as drawn right here, is this an exothermic or endothermic? It's exothermic, right, because it starts at high energy and it ends up at low energy. But what is actually flowing through all these different compounds? The electrons, right, they start at high energy from NADH, or FADH2, and then they flow through a number of other chemicals that can be reduced. Right? Remember, when something gains an electron, it becomes reduced. So the electrons actually hop from one chemical to another, and in so doing, they release some energy, and that energy can be used to make ATP. Right? So what kind of reaction? Is it exothermic or endothermic when ADP and inorganic phosphate is used to make ATP? That is endothermic, right? So there has to be a large exothermic reaction driving that process, and that's the flow of these electrons through these various cytochromes and other kinds of coenzymes. All right, and so this is what we call oxidative phosphorylation. And these electrons can only flow through ETC. When I say ETC, you should just think what? Electron transport chain. These electrons can only flow through if what is available to accept those electrons? There has to be something in our bodies available to accept those electrons, or else ETC is going to stop. Okay, it's got to be this oxygen right here. And so that's the reason why we inhale, right? To get oxygen inside our bodies so that those electrons can combine with it and some protons to form water. And in so doing, that gets rid of any reduced form of the cytochromes, and that keeps the electron transport chain operating. Right, so, for instance, if electrons were to build up someplace in any of these compounds, that would be like pyruvate building up inside the cytosol. What would happen to glycolysis if pyruvate built up inside the cell? Okay, and let's just say it couldn't take that side reaction to produce lactic acid. Let's just say that pyruvate was building up inside a cell. What would happen to glycolysis? Yeah, it would slow down because of what? Le Chatelier's principle, or the law of mass action, that would force glycolysis to run in the reverse direction. All right, so the same thing with these electrons. They have to be dumped out of the cell, and they're getting rid of by what? By this oxygen right here accepts those electrons so that ETC can run in the forward direction. All right, well, here's another exam figure. This shows, all right, the outer mitochondrial membrane and the inner mitochondrial membrane, and for sure you know this is a membrane. Why do you know this is a membrane right here? Because it's a nice phospholipid bilayer. All right, but don't forget, the better way of thinking about a membrane is what, the fluid mosaic model. So there are proteins that can be dissolved and other kinds of compounds dissolved in the plasma membrane, like we see on the inner mitochondrial membrane right here. I see a number of proteins and other kinds of coenzymes, and these are very special because the NADH and FADH get into the inner compartment of the mitochondria. What do we call that inner compartment? The innermost compartment, the deepest compartment. That is called the matrix of the mitochondria, right? And this is just the intermembrane space. So NAD and FADH from the cell have to get into the matrix. As a matter of fact, this is where the Krebs cycle takes place, even, is inside the matrix, and beta oxidation that we're going to talk about in a little bit. All right, so NADH right here, NADH, is this an oxidized or a reduced form of NAD? It's reduced, right? So there are high energy electrons in this compound, and so it can bump into, well, we call it FMH before, but you don't have to actually know it for the test. But this is a pump right here. When it gets energy from NADH by accepting these electrons, this pump becomes reduced, and these electrons flow to the next molecule in the chain. And when it does that, it can move hydrogen ions from a concentration, a low concentration, to a high concentration. So what do you call a membrane protein that can actually take something from a low concentration to a high concentration? What do you call something that takes water from down in the ground and brings it up to the surface? That's a pump, right? So this is a pump that can take protons from the matrix, which is in a low concentration, and put it in a high concentration in the intermembrane space between the mitochondrial membranes. But in order to do that, what does a pump need? It needs energy of some form, and the form of energy that is available to this protein right here is from these electrons. So this is a pretty fancy kind of pump. It almost kind of reminds me of an electric motor a little bit. Okay, and as these electrons flow through the rest of the ETC, right, you can see that there are three pumps. So when electrons flow through these pumps, then protons are moved from low concentration to high in this intermembrane space. And eventually we end up with a very high concentration of protons in the intermembrane space, which means what is the pH of this intermembrane space? Just for fun. It's what? Very, very acidic, right? Because it has a very high concentration of protons. All right, and then these electrons keep flowing. Why do these electrons keep flowing through ETC? Because there is oxygen available, and the last molecule really that's produced is a water molecule. All right, so now we have a big gradient of protons, high in the intermembrane space, low in the matrix. All right, so if we were to allow these protons to move, which way would they want to move automatically? From high concentration to low. And remember, so there's a big gradient, and remember, a gradient you should think of as an energy source. It's another form of energy. If we separate things out into two different compartments, right, these protons will want to flow from the intermembrane space down into the matrix. All right, but the mitochondria are pretty sophisticated. They don't allow that to happen except for one particular pathway. So here is a very special protein that is embedded in the membrane, and it has a proton channel in it. All right. This is what we call a respiratory assembly or a respiratory assembly. It's a really big, huge protein, and it's got a big button on the top of it. We can even see these things with an electron microscope. So we know they're there, we can see them, and we know a lot about how they operate. So this is a channel for protons. So protons will want to flow just by what? Diffusion from high concentration to low through this particular channel, but there is energy in the flow of those protons, and this respiratory assembly knows how to use that energy to take ADP and inorganic phosphate and put them together to make ATP as a result. So this thing right here, this respiratory assembly, we actually call an ATP synthase or an ATP synthetase. You can talk about it in either one of those two ways. All right, and that produces, all right, a lot of ATP for us. As a matter of fact, for every two sets of electrons, or for every pair of electrons that come through electron transport chain, we see, what, three pumps right here? So I think maybe just for a good ballpark idea, right, for every NADH, it's going to produce three ATP as a result.
When we have the hydrogen ions going from the first pump, from low to high,
yeah,
is it still correct to talk about active transport, or would it not be correct?
Yeah, this is active transport right here.
Okay.
Okay. And the energy is coming from these high energy electrons.
Okay.
Okay. It's that's certainly active transport. That won't happen automatically. That requires energy. But remember, energy can neither be created or destroyed. It just can be interconverted from one form to another. So the energy in these electrons is converted into a gradient of protons, and then this ATP synthase uses the energy in the gradient of protons to actually trap chemical energy in the form of ATP by synthesizing ATP. So this is what we call the chemiosmotic theory. And it's really handy to have these mitochondria around because these pumps don't have to be associated with the ATP synthase. All of these proteins can be in different locations because, you know, diffusion will take care of these protons floating around in the intermembrane space. All right, so this is a pretty good exam figure that you should know, and of course it's the, we call it the chemiosmotic theory. All right, I think I talked about this slide already. All right, so who's got a question about this? Anybody have a question about that? All right, so let's just summarize how respiration can make ATP. All right, there are basically two ways. There's one way that we call substrate level phosphorylation, or you could call it direct phosphorylation. That's when ATP is generated, when bonds are broken, and then that energy can be used to synthesize ATP. As a matter of fact, both the ATPs that are made with glycolysis are made from substrate level phosphorylation. And don't forget, in the Krebs cycle, there are also two ATPs for every glucose made in this way. So when glucose is metabolized, how many ATPs can be made by substrate level phosphorylation with considering glycolysis and the Krebs cycle together? How many are there? There are four. All right, there are only four. Now let's think about it another way. In order for pyruvate to enter the Krebs cycle, oxygen has to be available. All right, but now let's say there is no oxygen available. How many ATPs can be made from glucose when there is no oxygen available? Because what happens to pyruvate? Glucose gets chopped into 2-pyruvate, and then what happens to pyruvate? Yeah, it's kind of a dead end. It gets converted to lactic acid, and no more energy can be developed from it by the cell, so it's only the 2-ATP from glycolysis. So that's what we call the anaerobic pathway. All right, the second level, or the second way that ATP can be made is via oxidative phosphorylation. All right, and these are, oxidative phosphorylation is the result of producing NADHs and FADH2s, right, that we get some from glycolysis, we get some from the Krebs cycle, actually a lot from the Krebs cycle, and then those electrons in NADH and FADH2 are donated to the electron transport chain. And as a result of that, okay, we can get on the order of 30 or more ATPs. produced, all right, in this method. All right, so oxidative phosphorylation produces the bulk of all the ATP that we make. All right, so the theoretical yield for ATPs for every glucose, and we're going to take a look at this in just a little bit, is pretty high, just a little bit less than 40 ATPs for every glucose molecule. All right, but in real life, that doesn't really happen because these ATPs are inside the mitochondria. But where does your body need ATPs? They need it in the cytosol someplace. So it takes some energy to take all those ATPs that are in the matrix and shove them into the cytosol. That takes a couple ATPs. So in reality, for every glucose, there are about 30 ATPs made for every glucose because it costs a little bit to ship these ATPs around from the mitochondria back into the cytosol. All right. So I like to think that for every pair of electrons from NADH, right, the theoretical maximum would be 3 ATPs, but in reality we know it's a little bit less. All right, so we can say 2.5. And for every FADH2, or for every pair of electrons in FADH2, I like to say the theoretical maximum is 2 ATPs, but in real life we know it's a little bit less. So we say maybe 1.5. All right, so if we were to count up all the electrons from NADH and FADH that are produced by the respiration of glucose, we get a net of 26 ATP produced by electron transport chain. All right, so let me go back a couple slides. Because this shows us the entry point of electrons from NAD is where? Right at the top of electron transport. But where does FADH2 donate electrons? Not quite in the middle, but at a much lower energy. Therefore, FADH2 can't produce as many ATPs because it's actually missing one of those pumps. All right, so FADH2 is a lower energy compound compared to NADH. All right, so FADH2 would be donating electrons somewhere in this region, all right, of the electron transport chain. All right, so let's kind of look at a synopsis of where we get ATP from. So let's look at the reactions that we have. We have glucose going to pyruvate. What do we call that? That's glycolysis, right? That's glycolysis, and that's in the cytoplasm. If oxygen's available, pyruvate enters the mitochondria and it's converted into acetyl coenzyme A. I call that the preparatory reaction. It's the preparatory reaction for the Krebs cycle. All right, so here are three important reactions: glycolysis, the preparatory reaction, and Krebs cycle. All right, so let's review glycolysis. How many ATP are made? By substrate level phosphorylation, there are 4, but remember it takes 2 to get glycolysis going, so there's a net 2 ATP that are produced. But glycolysis also produces, right, 2 NADHs. All right, so these NADHs go into the mitochondria, and it takes a little bit of energy to get them in there, right? And so those electrons actually enter the mitochondria as FADH2s. And remember, we said that there are about 1.5 ATPs made for every FADH2, all right? Times how many get in there? 2 of them. So that's 3 ATP when these electrons are donated to electron transport chain. Right, so it costs a little bit of energy to get these electrons in NADH to get them into the mitochondria. All right, so 2 ATPs made directly via substrate level phosphorylation. And what kind of phosphorylation takes place when these high energy electrons are used to make ATP? That's oxidative phosphorylation, right? These high energy electrons via oxidative phosphorylation make ATP. So all of the ATP via glycolysis, if it's under aerobic conditions, right, is 2 ATP and another 3 ATP by oxidative phosphorylation. So this column here you could think of as substrate level, and over here you could call this, what, oxidative phosphorylation. All right, so that's for glycolysis. All right, now the preparatory reaction, all right, remember that for every glucose, how many pyruvate do you get? You get 2, right, because glucose is chopped in half. And in this preparatory reaction, it actually makes and NADH. Right, so it doesn't make any ATP by substrate level phosphorylation, but it makes an NADH, and because there are two pyruvates for every glucose, right, we have to multiply it by two. Right, so we got two NADHs, and then because it takes energy to get ATP out of the mitochondria, we don't say three ATP per NADH. We have to say, we have to discount it a little bit, 2.5. So 2.5 times two is 5 ATP. All right, so we've accounted for substrate level phosphorylation, oxidative phosphorylation through the preparatory reaction. All right, so now the last reaction that we got to consider is the Krebs cycle. The Krebs cycle, remember, produces one substrate level ATP via the GTP exchange mechanism right there. But remember, how many times does the Krebs cycle turn for every glucose? It makes two turns, right, because there are two pyruvates that are made, so that's actually two ATP. Now, how many NADHs are made by the Krebs cycle? There are three. There's three steps, and then there's one step that makes an FADH. All right, and remember, there's two turns for every glucose molecule, so we multiply these by two. So 2.5 ATP molecules per NADH, right, times three. Right, is 7.5 ATP, but remember Krebs cycle turns around twice for every glucose, so that's 15 ATP made from these NADHs of the Krebs cycle. Right, FADH, one FADH is made by Krebs, and remember it goes around twice, so there are actually two of them. So 1.5 ATP per FADH2, and two turns of the Krebs cycle would produce three ATPs. So, under aerobic conditions, respiration produces, what, a net gain of 4 ATP by substrate level phosphorylation? And you know what? You should probably put substrate level, because that's how I like to word it. I usually don't say direct phosphorylation. I say substrate level phosphorylation versus, all right, there's 26 that are made by oxidative phosphorylation, and we add all of these together, including, right, we're taking into account some of the losses in this particular system because it's not absolutely perfect, we would say 30 ATP are made for every glucose molecule. All right, so now we can contrast anaerobic respiration with aerobic respiration. All right, so aerobic respiration produces how many ATP? All right, you would say 30-something. Right, if we're going to be very particular and take into account all the losses, right here I just showed you 30. The theoretical maximum might be closer to 40, and under some conditions inside the cell, it might be 34, 35, or 36, or 38, and in different tissues, different amounts, right? And as scientists, we are very interested in all those numbers and we'll talk about that for the next 100 years. But on your test, okay, what are you going to say for aerobic respiration? What is, like, the thing you should have in mind? For every glucose, under aerobic conditions, how many ATP is it going to produce? 30-something, right? And if you want to say 30, that's fine. If you want to say 35 or 36 or 38, that's fine with me too. Now, for every one, for a glucose molecule undergoing anaerobic respiration, that means pyruvate is being shunted into lactic acid, how many ATP are being produced? Right? There's really not much discussion about that anymore. Right? It's 2 ATP. So you got two forms of cellular respiration. Anaerobic making 2 ATP versus aerobic respiration that is making 30-something. All right? What do you think is the most beneficial system to have in your bodies? All right? Aerobic respiration, because it just get so much more currency, energy currency, out for your cellular processes compared to anaerobic respiration. So sometimes I think of maybe a comparison this way, right? Let's just say we got a couple of gas stations, right? Gas station A, gas station B, and gas station A is $5 per gallon, and gas station B is $5 per gallon. And when you look at the cost of that, does it matter what gas station you go to? Would you make a choice based on that? No, because it's still just too expensive, right? All right, but if you know gas station A, you buy the gas for $5 a gallon, you're going to get 2 miles per gallon. All right? And then you know that at gas station B, the gas is a little bit different, and you're going to get 30 miles per gallon. Now what gas station are you going to go to? Yeah, okay, so the same thing for respiration as well. We, our cells, because we can undergo oxidative phosphorylation, we can recoup so much more energy from glucose compared to more less evolved cells, right? It's a huge advantage for us. Okay. All right, so that's the big difference that I want you to know about. All right, and also just appreciate how energy can be converted from one form to another, right? From chemical energy in ATP, from energy in high energy electrons, in terms of the chemical gradient across the inner mitochondrial membrane, and we use that to run our cellular processes. All right, so let's talk a little bit, let's change topics a little bit and talk about fat metabolism. Oops, I wanted to highlight that. Fat metabolism, and really not so much protein metabolism. Okay, but you should know, give me an example of a fat. What's an example of a fat? Okay, steroid is a fat, I agree. That's not the one I want to talk about right now, so I want another example. Okay, I'm thinking in particular of a triglyceride. All right, so what are the building blocks of a triglyceride? 3 fatty acids and a glycerol, right, that are put together via some kind of dehydration synthesis reaction. So, for instance, if your body wants to metabolize a fat or a triglyceride, it can be broken down into what? Its building blocks, which is what? Glycerol and these 3 fatty acids. And we call that process, what is that process that is used to break a triglyceride down into glycerol and 3 fatty acids? That is, yeah, hydrolysis. Right, so you need a water molecule to be broken as well. All right, and then these products right here can be run through either glycolysis or the Krebs cycle to make other kinds of compounds or to generate energy. All right. And these proteins can be broken down into their building blocks, amino acids, and this is about the only thing I'm going to say about protein metabolism. Remember that an amino acid has got a carboxyl group and it's got an amino group. That amino group can be deaminated, can be taken off of the amino acid, and then the remnants of that amino acid can be run through the Krebs cycle to generate energy. Right? So some of these pathways can be used to interconvert various kinds of chemicals we have in our body. Like it can be used to take carbohydrates and turn them into fats or use them to make certain kinds of amino acids that can be used to make proteins. And one of the intermediate steps or one of the keystones in this metabolism is acetyl-CoA. Now, what can you tell me about acetyl-coenzyme A or an acetyl group? How many carbon atoms are in an acetyl group? There are 2. That's right. Okay. And how many carbons are in pyruvic acid or pyruvate? There are 3. So there is no place in our bodies that we can take a 2-carbon molecule and convert it into a 3-carbon molecule. So acetyl-CoA can't be used, right, to make sugars as a result of that. Right, because we have to add a carbon at this particular level. There's no way that we can do that in our body. So once something becomes acetyl-CoA, there are really only 2 possible fates for it. It can enter the Krebs cycle. You can generate a lot of ATP from it, which is wonderful because you need ATP. Or acetyl-CoA, or this acetyl group, can be used to make fatty acids, which can be used to make fat when it's synthesized with glycerol right here. All right, so once something is a 2-carbon fragment, it can no longer make any sugars for you. All right, and for instance, when there's plenty of ATP in the body, okay, this acetyl-CoA does not enter the Krebs cycle. It actually enters a fat metabolism, and a fat is made out of it. right? So when you're in a fed state with a lot of ATP, the energy that you consume ends up as acetyl-CoA, which then is converted into fat. Okay, and what about fat? Right, fat or triglyceride can be broken down into fatty acids and glycerol. Glycerol can be used to make sugars because how many carbons are in glycerol? There are three, right? So that can enter glycolysis, and it can be used to make glucose, for instance. But these fatty acids, right, can never be used to make a sugar molecule. Okay, it can only be used for energy. All right, so acetyl-CoA can be used to make cholesterol, which is used to make steroid hormones, for instance, or bile acids that we're going to see are used for breaking down lipids in the digestive process. And acetyl-CoA can be used to make fatty acids for the synthesis of triglycerides and phospholipids, building blocks of a membrane, or it can be used to make energy via Krebs cycle. But nowhere in here do you see acetyl-CoA being used to make a sugar molecule. Can't be used to make a sugar molecule, okay, because it only is a two-carbon fragment. Other animals are able to do that, but we can't. All right, the intermediates of the Krebs cycle right here, all right, we see have many more carbon units than just two, right? These have four, these over here have six, and we have some five. These right here, these intermediates of the Krebs cycle, can be made from sugar molecules, right? As a matter of fact, they have to be made from sugar molecules. So what is the only way that acetyl-CoA can be metabolized by the Krebs cycle? It's only when you have available sugars in your body, right, as a result. So if you don't have sugars in your body or sugar can't get into a cell, like when somebody has diabetes, what happens to acetyl-CoA metabolism? Okay, it can't enter the Krebs cycle, right? It can't enter because these intermediates of the Krebs cycle disappear because there's no sugars. And then these acetyl-CoAs are converted into what we call ketone bodies. And these ketone bodies are things like acetone. And then we just breathe those compounds right out of our body. So is there a way that you can think of acetone? Have you ever used acetone in your daily life? For instance, it's fingernail polish remover. Right? It's highly volatile, evaporates very, very quickly. Right? So when people go on certain kinds of diets that are low in sugars, the Krebs cycle has a tendency to shut down, and this acetyl-CoA, which what comes from fat, right, we just actually breathe right out of our bodies. So that's a really kind of ingenious kind of diet, right? So just by starving yourself of glucose, what can we do with all that extra weight we're carrying? We don't have to exercise it off. We can just exhale it, right, just by not eating any sugars. And what is that diet called? That's called starvation. This is true. I'm glad that you are concerned about that. Okay, that's what we call, it used to be really trendy maybe 5 or 10 years ago now. That's called the Atkins diet, okay, where you restrict your intake of sugars, and people can lose dramatic amounts of weight because their lipids are being converted into ketone bodies that you breathe right out of your body. But what do you think the drawback to that is? If you don't have the Krebs cycle working, you're not making ATP. Do you think ATP is a good thing to have? Absolutely. Okay, I've known people on an Atkins diet, they're so devoid of energy, currency, namely ATP, that they get so dingy that they drive on the wrong side of the road. Okay, they can maintain consciousness, but not a really good kind of consciousness, right? So I wouldn't take a physiology test while being on an Atkins diet, for instance. Okay. And that's because you need some sugars to metabolize this acetyl group, right, to generate those NADHs and FADH2s. All right. But nonetheless, if you do have sugars in your diet, then fats provide a very nice form of energy that can make a lot of ATP. All right, and fat is really nice because it contains a high amount of energy, 9 kilocalories per gram. All right, sugars and proteins only have about 4 kilocalories. And a calorie is what? A measure of the amount of energy. So you can do twice as much work on the same amount of fat compared to sugars or proteins. All right, so how do we get energy from fats we have in our body? Like, for instance, a triglyceride. Well, fat is broken down into what? The building blocks, fatty acids and glycerol, by an enzyme we call lipase. That's a hydrolysis reaction. And then acetyl-CoAs are made from these fatty acids, and that serves as a major energy source in many tissues. All right, so here's the last slide in this particular chapter. The process that breaks down fatty acids, right? So here we have a fatty acid, and remember, a fatty acid has many, many carbons in a row right here, right? And let's just say it has 16. Maybe this is a 16-carbon fatty acid. So there's going to be 16 of these carbons, and on one end there's this carboxyl group. Here is the first carbon next to the carboxyl group. Here's the second carbon next to the carboxyl group. So we call those the alpha carbon and the beta carbon in terms of organic chemistry. And the way fatty acids are broken down, they're broken down by 2 carbon fragments at a time. What do we call a 2-carbon fragment? That's an acetyl group, right? An acetyl group. So coenzyme A comes in, and this bond is broken, and this acetyl group is bound to coenzyme A, and then it becomes what? Acetyl coenzyme A we have right here. That takes an ATP molecule to get this process started. But through the next steps and this rearrangement, right, this 2-carbon fragment is broken off of the fatty acid, and that acetyl-CoA can enter the Krebs cycle. And for every acetyl-CoA, that will produce 10 ATPs. Right, so how many 2-carbon fragments are made from a 16-carbon fatty acid? 8, right? So just divide it by 2. So for a 16-carbon fatty acid, okay, you get 8 times 10, which would be 80 ATPs just produced by the Krebs cycle. But look what happens with beta oxidation when we break off an acetyl group from an existing fatty acid. There's one step that produces an FADH2. And how many ATPs are made from this FADH2? It would be, 1.5. And there's an NADH that's also produced. That produces an additional 2.5. So if we add up the ATPs made by the beta oxidation, which happens before the Krebs cycle, we get what? 2, 3, we get 4 ATPs. All right, and how many times do we actually have to snip off a 2-carbon fragment if it's a 16-carbon unit? It would be actually 7 times. All right, so the first time you clip off 2, next time you clip off 2, you have to undergo that reaction 7 times, and then the 7th time, what do? You take a 4-carbon molecule and you end up with 2 carbons. So you don't actually have to do it 8 times, you do it 7 times. So 7 times, 4. 7 times 4 is 28, all right, plus 80. Okay, so that's what, about 108 ATPs are made from this fatty acid right here. All right, so that just kind of underscores what an important energy molecule fatty acids are in our body. Right, and we can store a tremendous amount of ATP in fatty acids. Okay, so that's kind of it for metabolism. But, you know, there's just one last other thing that's really interesting. All right, we said an acetyl group has got how many carbons in it? 2. Okay, and what is that that compound in adult beverage that some of us, maybe one or two of us in here, sometimes partake of to poison our nervous system? What is that? Alcohol, right? Ethyl alcohol, right? Which is, right, this guy right here, OH. That's ethyl alcohol. That's what's in adult beverage. So how many carbons do you see right there? 2. All right, this particular molecule has got two carbons. There's no way to convert this molecule into a sugar. What are the possible fates for ethyl alcohol in your body? It really is converted into an acetyl group, and that acetyl group can do what? Can go into the Krebs cycle, which is fine because you can make a lot of energy out of it. But what is the only other possible fate for ethyl alcohol? To make fatty acids out of it. Okay? Can't make sugar out of it. So when you drink ethyl alcohol, what is that like eating?
Fat.
It's like eating fat. Yeah, it's like eating a bar of butter. Okay? That's another reason why people hate this class. All right, because you learn a little bit about that metabolism. Once something is a two-carbon fragment, you can't make a sugar out of it again. Yeah.
What's the difference between the electron transport chain?
Okay. Electron transport chain, you should know about where it takes place inside the cell. All right, and so for instance, beta oxidation takes place right where Krebs cycle takes place, which is in the matrix of a mitochondria. All right, so all of those enzymes are dissolved within the fluid of that inner compartment of the mitochondria, which we call the matrix. All right, so that's one difference. Oxidative phosphorylation takes place on the inner mitochondrial membrane. And it uses the intermembrane space to hold the protons, and it uses the matrix to accept the protons. But maybe you should think of electron transport as actually being embedded in the inner membrane of the mitochondria. It's really not, those proteins are not dissolved in the matrix floating around inside the mitochondria. Another big difference is that beta oxidation produces NADH and FADH2. So that's the high energy output for beta oxidation. And what's the high energy output for electron transport? Does electron transport produce NADHs or FADH2s? Okay. It does it. What electron transport produces is ATP, right? So electron transport actually utilizes NADH and FADH2 to make ATP. So that's really the big difference between beta oxidation. Beta oxidation produces NADH and FADH2. Oxidative phosphorylation uses those NADHs and FADH2s to make ATP. So beta oxidation, if I was going to think of it as a certain kind of metabolism that we talked about, I would think of beta oxidation kind of like a Krebs cycle. But it's something that comes from fats. Right, it produces NADH2 and FADH2 just like the Krebs cycle does. And then those are called coenzymes because they take those high energy electrons and donate it to another biochemical pathway, which is what? Electron transport. So FADH2 and NADH are coenzymes carrying these electrons around from either beta oxidation to ETC or Krebs cycle to ETC. Well, in order to get energy from beta oxidation, you need to have electron transport chain working. Because beta oxidation only really makes NADH and FADH2s. So you need electron transport to convert that energy into ATP. All right, so maybe you could think of electron transport as an engine, a chemical engine that converts high energy electrons into those high energy covalent bonds in ATP. So remember, energy can be converted from one form to another, but can't be created. So ETC converts that energy from electrons to covalent bonds. So it acts kind of like an engine. Does that sort of answer your question? Yeah? Okay. Yeah. How is it formed by, well, in terms of the preparatory reaction, you have pyruvate, All right, so a number of different ways. Pyruvate, right? Pyruvate has got three carbons, but then it's converted into acetyl coenzyme A plus CO2. All right, so acetyl coenzyme A can be produced by a decarboxylation of pyruvic acid. So yeah, so this is a preparatory reaction. So that decarboxylation, all right, makes pyruvate lose that one carbon, which ends up as CO2. And what do we do with CO2? We exhale it from our body. But the other thing that this does, what else does this do? This takes an NAD plus, right, and produces what? An NADH. And then these electrons in here are donated to electron transport to make even more ATP. All right, so this preparatory reaction is handy because it makes NADH. Yeah, yeah. Okay, and the other place where acetyl coenzyme is made is when you have a fatty acid and the two terminal carbons are chopped off. Then we call that beta oxidation. Beta oxidation doesn't produce CO2. It just produces acetyl CoA directly because it chops off two carbons at a time. So I think, to me, that answers your question. How are you doing with that explanation? Okay, were you right?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Yeah. All right, so another interesting question I could ask you, what organelle produces CO2? Mitochondria, because what's inside mitochondria? This preparatory reaction. And what's the other set of chemical reactions that make CO2? Is the Krebs cycle. And that's inside the matrix of the mitochondria as well. Okay. Okay. All right, well, should I tell you what I think the trickiest thing in this chapter is? Okay, the trickiest thing that you should pay attention to is, for some reason, for me, oxidation reduction reactions. When something becomes oxidized, right, something's got to become reduced, and it's hard for me to remember what is the oxidizing agent, what's the reducing agent, so pay particular attention to those oxidation reduction reactions, and you have a nice generic form of a redox reaction in your textbook. That's one of those exam figures, and it's just with a chemical called X. All right, so just memorize that and use that as a nice model in your mind for oxidation reduction reactions. Yeah? So you do not have to be concerned with amino acid metabolism. Yeah, this is true. Okay, you should know what the building block of a protein is, right? And proteins can be broken down into amino acids. And amino acids can be, some parts of them can be placed into Krebs cycle to generate energy after they're deaminated, because there's an amino group on every amino acid. Okay? Okay. So, yep, that's it for this chapter. So that takes us to, this might be the most fun chapter in the book, but metabolism is pretty fun, but this one actually is pretty fun too. Oh yeah, who's got a sign-in sheet? Who has start a sign-in sheet over there and pass it around and then pass it back down to the front. Just put the date on it. It's already started, fantastic. If there's more than one, as long as I get them all, it's not such a big deal. Okay, so the first part of this chapter is kind of a nice review of anatomy, but I've got a feeling a lot of people are forgetting a lot of anatomy, so we're going to go over it really quickly just to make sure. All right, so the nervous system, what are the two main parts of the nervous system? It can be broken down into central versus peripheral, and what is the central nervous system? Brain and spinal cord, okay, and peripheral nervous system is what? Everything else outside, yeah, okay, including what? All the cranial nerves and all the spinal nerves. Cranial nerves come from the brain, spinal nerves come from the spinal cord. All right, furthermore, the nervous system or nervous tissue is made out of two kinds of cells. What are the two kinds of cells? We have neurons, and they're specialized for transmitting electrical information. And then there are cells that don't transmit electrical information. We call those support cells or neuroglia or neuroglial cells. Right? So practice saying that. So the neurons really we think of as the functional unit of the nervous system because they're transmitting the information from one place to another that's very, very fast. But you know what? People are really becoming more and more interested in glial cells. Even though they don't transmit information, they sometimes tell the neuron where to go and what to do. So we're actually thinking that the support cells might be even more important than the neurons. So we're changing our whole perspective. And the nervous system has many, many more times, as much as maybe five times the number compared to neurons. So these glial cells help neurons take up chemicals, for instance, like glucose. Glial cells tell neurons how to interconnect with each other. So they're becoming more and more important. All right, so let's talk about neurons first. Okay, they gather and transmit information by responding to stimuli, right? They produce and send electrical chemical impulses, and they can release chemical messengers, right? And those chemical messengers, since it's coming from a neuron, we call that a neurotransmitter, right? Coming from a neuron. All right, so I do want you to know, recall your anatomy, I do want you to know neurons by their shape and by their function. All right, so neurons have a cell body, so there's a center of mass with a nucleus in it, a lot of rough endoplasmic reticulum, which we call Nissl substance, right, that's producing neurotransmitter and other factors that a neuron needs. There are a number of processes coming off the cell body, and if they're short, we call these dendrites. Right? And then there's usually one process that's coming off that is extremely long. It could be 100 or 1,000 or maybe even 10,000 times the length of the cell body, but of course it's still microscopically thin. This thing might go from your spinal cord all the way down to the tip of your toe. So it can be extremely long. And this is what we call an axon. And information always travels, right, from a dendrite into the cell body and down an axon. Information, right, does not flow from the end of an axon into the cell body and out a dendrite. So information flows as a one-way street in a neuron. All right, in your lifetime, you might have to change that, but this is a really good place to start. Okay, so the dendrites and cell body, we think of as being the receiving end of a neuron, and an axon as the sending end of a neuron, because signals go from dendrite to cell body to axon. So this particular neuron that we see right here is what we call a multipolar neuron, and this is what we find typically in a motor neuron or maybe an interneuron inside the central nervous system. It has this particular kind of shape. We do see a second kind of neuron down over here. We see dendrites. This is the receiving end, and it comes up to the cell body, and then here is the axon, and I can see these little bulges at the tip of an axon. Can you see these little bulges over here on this multipolar neuron? Because this is where neurotransmitter is going to be released from, and the dendrites are shown as what? Being very thin kinds of processes right here, as we see on these dendrites right here, so that's why I know these are dendrites. So this kind of neuron is what we call a unipolar. And unipolar neurons are found in a few places in the body, mostly in special sense organs, like your eyes and your nose, for instance. They're not motor neurons, right, but they are this is a unipolar, right, but this is a sensory neuron. So this, and what do we mean by sense? Which way are signals moving? The two kinds are either what, motor or sensory, right? Motor is taking signals from the central nervous system out to the periphery, but this unipolar neuron is a sensory neuron. It's taking what, information from the periphery, bringing it into the central nervous system. So one would be called afferent, and the other would be called afferent and efferent. This motor neuron here is efferent. This sensory neuron here is afferent. Okay. Kind of botched that up. Do I have a bipolar neuron anywhere? Oh, I don't have a bipolar neuron anywhere. Maybe in one of the next slides. Okay. All right, so let's talk about some other things about neurons. You should also become familiar, I'm going to go back to here, maybe I have a diagram later on. The third kind of neuron would be a bipolar. All right, and a bipolar neuron looks like this. Here is the cell body. All right, and then here are some dendrites, and coming out the other end is the axon. So this is what we call a bipolar, and that's what we have in some special sense organs, like our eyes, for instance, and ears. All right, so bipolar is a special sensory neuron. All right, so things can move along an axon, okay, in a couple of different ways. There's exoplasmic flow and axonal transport, because things have to get from the cell body all the way down to the axon terminus over here. So these are the two methods. Exoplasmic flow moves soluble compounds toward the nerve endings via a rhythmic contraction of the axon. So the axon actually kind of, there's like peristalsis. There's motion within the axons, and that's just caused by the microfilaments and microtubules that are inside the cell, all right, and that's a relatively slow process. The second kind of transport is what we call axonal transport, all right, and there's a couple different kinds of axonal transport, and it's used for a little bit different purpose. Axonal transport moves large and insoluble compounds along an axon, so it doesn't have to be a part of the solution. It could be even maybe a vesicle or something that can move from the cell body down to an axon terminal, right? And they're guided by microtubules, and this is a very fast kind of motion compared to exoplasmic flow, right? So these microtubules act as little motor systems or monorails that move things around down through an axon. And as you can imagine, there are monorails that move material away from the cell body down to an axon terminus. We call that anterograde transport. Right? And the anterograde just means in a forward direction. So forward flow is anterograde transport. These use little motor proteins called kinesins. And kinesins can attach to a microtubule, right, and also to something that is going to move, and that's going to move it down to the axon terminus. All right, as opposed to retrograde transport. And what does retrograde mean? It means backward. Yeah, so I don't really want to use those terms in here. I really want to use anterograde and retrograde in all cases. All right, so retrograde transport moves material from the ends of the processes back into the cell body, and it uses microtubules again, but a little bit different kind of motor protein. We call these dynenes. And as a matter of fact, some viruses have learned how to use these dynenes, right, to transport themselves around inside the cell. Okay, for instance, when a virus enters a neuron from an axon terminus, it can find its way all the way up to the cell body by hopping a ride on the microtubule system using a dynein molecule. Okay, let's talk about that functional classification of neurons. We talked about it just a little bit. Well, we've got sensory or afferent neurons, that's one class. We have motor or efferent, that's another class. So here is a nice unipolar neuron with the dendrites in the periphery, right? And then it comes up this process and it goes into the central nervous system. So here is the cell body that typically we find. Where do we typically find this? Can anybody remember where we have this? We see it's still in the peripheral nervous system, but that would be, there's a little, what do we call this pathway that's entering the spinal cord? Okay. Or there could be a pathway leaving, These things entering or leaving the spinal cord are what we call roots. Does that ring a bell? Either a dorsal root or a ventral root. Okay? And all sensory information comes in through the dorsal root. So this is a physiology book, so it's not really drawn like anatomy, because I see what the sensory root and the motor root kind of entering at the same location. Right? That never happens in real life. Right, the sensory neuron enters the dorsal root, and the motor root always leaves via the ventral root. Right? Okay. So here we have a nice bipolar neuron, and the cell body would be in the dorsal root ganglia. Right? Because the ganglia is a group of nerve cell bodies someplace where in the peripheral nervous system. So can you picture that dorsal root ganglia in your anatomy book? And it was a part of the dorsal root. Okay. So, then neurons that are completely contained within the central nervous system, we call those association neurons or interneurons. And there are none in this diagram. All right, but all of the neurons that make up the spinal cord and brain are what we call interneurons. And the third kind of neuron would be a neuron that takes information away from the central nervous system. And typically these are multipolar neurons. And these leave the spinal cord via the ventral root. So these would be motor or efferent. All right, so try to remember, this is going to be important when we get to the next chapter. Basically, there are two general kinds of motor neurons. There are motor neurons that innervate skeletal muscle. We call this a somatic motor neuron. So what kind of function does a somatic motor neuron have? Okay, somebody said voluntary. Okay, that's exactly what I was thinking. Voluntary means what? Skeletal muscle, you have voluntary control over. You can cause that muscle to contract or relax. It all depends on your thinking. And, okay, as a matter of fact, skeletal muscle is the only thing that you have voluntary control over. Everything else is taken care of for you automatically. And the proper term for automatic control is what we call what? Autonomic control. So the autonomic nervous system is controlling things that you don't have voluntary control over. And what are the three things that your autonomic nervous system controls? Yeah. Glands, yeah. Cardiac muscle, and smooth muscle. That's right. And then the only other thing that's left over is skeletal muscle. That's controlled by your somatic or voluntary nervous system. The other thing that you notice on this slide right here is that for a signal to go from the central nervous system to an effector like skeletal muscle requires how many neurons? Just one. Okay, this is a review from anatomy as well. But in an autonomic outflow pathway, how many neurons does it take to get from central nervous system to effector organ? It always takes two. Remember, here's the preganglionic neuron, here is the postganglionic neuron. All right, so if that's not ringing a real clear bell, probably you should get your anatomy books out and just kind of look at that one more time. That'll be real important in the next chapter. All right, so here are those basic three shapes of neurons that we talked about, the multipolar, here's the bipolar, okay, and then here's the unipolar. If you want to call it pseudo-unipolar, that's fine with me, but know what the functions of these things are, right? So here's a sensory. Here's an efferent motor neuron. This would be for a special sense of some kind. All right. We did mention glial cells in anatomy, but kind of in passing. But now we want to talk a little bit more particular about some of the functions. Which kind of leads me back to neurons. Make sure you can recognize a neuron by its shape, but that's easy because that's just old anatomy. But you should also know it by its function. So if I show you the shape of a neuron, you should know automatically what its function is, right? And if you change the shape of a neuron, guess what you're changing? You're changing its function as well, right? Okay. Okay, so there are certain cells in the peripheral nervous system, okay, that wrap insulation around an axon. And that insulation is a lipid, we call it myelin, and the cells that wrap myelin around an axon is called a Schwann cell. And that only happens in the peripheral nervous system. And Schwann cells don't lay down a continuous layer of insulation around an axon. It produces these little nodes. And these are what we call nodes of Ranvier. So electrical information right, doesn't flow continuously down an axon. It can actually flow by hopping from one node to the other. And when it hops, that increases the speed of conduction. So myelinated axons could be as many as 100 times faster compared to a non-myelinated axon. All right, so that's produced by Schwann cells. The other kinds of cells I don't think I have a picture of are satellite cells. Satellite cells you would find in the peripheral nervous system because they would completely surround the cell body of a unipolar neuron in the dorsal root ganglia. And since they kind of surround the cell body, it kind of look like planets or moons that are actually circling a planet. If you look at Jupiter, it's got a number of moons, and people that studied biology like to study astronomy way back when people were developing techniques for microscopy and telescopes at the same time. And it kind of reminded them of looking at Jupiter with a bunch of moons around it, and so they called those what? Satellite cells as a result, because they're just surrounding the cell body of those of the dorsal root ganglia. All right, so myelin is the compound, and a Schwann cell will just wrap itself around an axon, wrap itself around. The myelin sheath are these inner layers, and as the cell is wrapping itself around, this is the outermost layer, is where the cytoplasm of the cell ends up, including the nucleus. And so the part of a Schwann cell that has cytoplasm and not myelin is what we call the neurilemma, which is what, the most superficial part of the Schwann cell. Here you can see some cytoplasm, right? And that just electrically insulates or isolates that axon. All right, so that's for the peripheral nervous system. The central nervous system has got a number of support cells or neuroglia cells. You can see something here that looks like a Schwann cell. It's making a myelin sheath with nodes of Ranvier. All right, so it's very similar to a Schwann cell, but notice there are many different processes. All right, so one of these myelin-forming cells, which is what we call an oligodendrocyte in the central nervous system, makes the myelin sheath, but it can make different segments. One cell can make different segments on an axon, and one oligodendrocyte not only can make different segments, but it can even make different segments on what? Different axons from different neurons. All right, so an oligodendrocyte is highly branched as opposed to a Schwann cell, which is what? Just makes one little wrap around an axon in the peripheral nervous system. So that's one easy way to tell the difference between an oligodendrocyte and a Schwann cell. Right, so if you see this, right, what part of the nervous system is this? Would you say peripheral nervous system or central? Central, because of all the processes on this oligodendrocyte. All right, so that's one kind of cell. Here is another kind of support cell. This is called a microglia cell or microglial cell. This is an immunological cell. All right, so it's crawling around inside the brain all the time looking for what? All kinds of junk that doesn't belong there. Bacteria, viruses, tumor cells, right, cell fragments, and the microglia cell is going to phagocytize it and then destroy what should not be there. All right, so these are shapeshifters that are moving around all over the place. That's a second kind of cell. The third kind of cell I see right here is an astrocyte. All right, and somebody named it an astrocyte because it reminded them as looking at a star through a telescope, because it has all these rays coming out of it. Okay, and you can see an astrocyte has a number of processes. Some of the processes have perivascular feet that attach to a capillary, right, which has blood in it. And another process is attached to the cell body and maybe a dendrite of a neuron. And so an astrocyte can act as a bridge between compounds that are in the blood and a neuron. So it acts as a delivery system for compounds that are in the blood to this particular neuron. So give me an example of a compound this neuron might like to have.
Acetyl-CoA.
Okay. Yeah, acetyl-CoA. Don't find that in the blood too much. But for instance, what is regulated and maintained in your blood that's used to make ATP? Glucose. Right, so these astrocytes can actually take up glucose and then help nourish this neuron here directly because of these little bridge processes. So that's one function. All right, so this capillary, so what's the function of a capillary?
Exchange.
And why does exchange take place at on a capillary but not a vein or an artery? Because it has a really thin wall, right? It only has an endothelium. It doesn't have any of the other tunics. So a capillary is extremely thin, and it might even have little holes through it, which we call fenestrations, that allow material to leak out, all right, but not in the brain. So for exchange, you have this capillary, but that exchange is enhanced due to this astrocyte right here. All right, so that's a third kind of cell. And then the fourth kind of cell is what we call an ependymal cell. Remember, there are spaces inside the brain filled with cerebral spinal fluid. And there is a lining on those ventricles of the brain that act as a barrier so that whatever in the cerebral spinal fluid doesn't have direct access to these neurons, right? Because we don't want that to happen, because these neurons are very sensitive. If the pH in your body changes or the cerebral spinal fluid changes, that's going to affect how these neurons are going to behave. That might produce a coma. Or if there is an infection in the cerebral spinal fluid, you don't want those bacteria or viruses having direct access to these neurons, because that could be, what, immediately fatal. So the ependymal cells act as a little barrier, but they also do something else. In a few places, these ependymal cells are highly vascularized, and they actually make the cerebral spinal fluid. So that's another job of these ependymal cells. They make cerebral spinal fluid, right? But what do we call those specialized regions? There's about three or four of those regions of ependymal cells that have a special blood supply that makes CSF. What do we call those things? What did you learn in anatomy? What are those things that, those areas that make cerebral spinal fluid or CSF? They're in the ventricles. Yeah, they're in the lateral ventricles, roof of the third ventricle, roof of the fourth ventricle. Those are what we call the choroid plexus. Right, so the choroid plexus is made out of these ependymal support cells. All right, so where would you find ependymal cells? The PNS or CNS? Yeah, the central nervous system, right? Because they line the ventricles and they make cerebral spinal fluid. Okay. Well, here's just another really nice picture of what kind of cell. This would be an oligodendrocyte. You should know where that is. That's in what part of the nervous system? The central nervous system, right, okay. Okay, now depending on the location of an axon, when it gets injured, right, it can either regenerate itself or not regenerate itself. And that has to do with not the axon itself, but the kinds of neuroglia cell that surrounds it. All right, so regeneration occurs much more readily in the peripheral nervous system compared to the central nervous system. And the reason is that what kind of cell produces the myelin sheath in the PNS? Schwann cell. And in the central nervous system, it's the oligodendrocyte. Well, one of the jobs of the oligodendrocyte is to make sure that neurons don't go to places except to where they belong. So oligodendrocytes kind of inhibit neurons from growing in the central nervous system all the time. All right, so that when a neuron in the central nervous system gets damaged, the oligodendrocytes actually produce proteins that inhibit regrowth, right? Because it forms a scar, a glial scar over the end of that axon, and it blocks regrowth. But in the peripheral nervous system, right, when an axon is damaged or cut, okay, these Schwann cells, right, these fragments of Schwann cells actually reform a tube that guides the regrowth of that axon back to its proper effector organ. Right, so this is what we call a regeneration tube that results from the growth of these Schwann cells right here. So in the central nervous system, the oligodendrocytes inhibit regrowth because it forms a glial scar over the end of a damaged axon, but in the peripheral nervous system, the Schwann cells actually enhance regeneration because it forms this regeneration tube. All right, and I'm sure somebody's looking at taking Schwann cells from a person's peripheral nervous system and maybe trying to transplant them into a person's central nervous system if it's been damaged, like in a spinal cord injury or something, to see if that will promote regrowth of a neuron through a spinal cord. Okay, that would be pretty cool if somebody could figure out how to do that. Okay, just by using a little bit different kind of cell. Okay, neurotrophin is a chemical compound that stimulates nerve growth. All right, and this is probably the last thing that I'll talk about in just a little bit. Okay, so neuro means what? Neuron. Trophin, what does trophin mean? Anybody have a clue for what a trophin means? It means to actually feed or nourish a neuron. So a neurotrophin is a chemical compound that promotes nerve growth. And as a matter of fact, even in the adult, we used to think that when we're born, we have a certain number of neurons in our brain, and then after a certain period of time, very early in development, we don't ever get any more neurons, and they just kind of slowly die as we get older. Okay, but now we know that that's not really true. All right, that our brain can produce new neurons as a result of these factors that we call neurotrophins. So our brain actually can grow, and we don't really know very much about this. We do know a lot about, say, blood. Okay? How many blood cells does your body produce every second? Okay, millions. Yeah, maybe 3 million every second, right? Because there's a high turnover. What about bones? How often do you have to rebuild your skeleton? It's every 5 years. It gets rebuilt. All right? Now, your brain doesn't get rebuilt to that extent, but it still does get remodeled and rebuilt as a result of these neurotrophins. As a matter of fact, when you take a really good class, like a music appreciation class, or English literature, or anatomy, or even a physiology class, in order for you to learn new things, guess what has to happen to your brain? It's got to grow and remodel and make new connections. So there has to be changes in the structure of your brain because it's going to, what, function differently when you learn information. Right, just like if you were to contract a muscle, what would happen to that muscle? It would change its structure, right? It would get bigger and stronger. The same thing with a person's brain as a result of being stimulated by these neurotrophins. All right, and it's also important for regeneration. So I'm going to come back to this. The cells that secrete neurotrophins are astrocytes. All right, so not only do they take glucose, right, but they also cause your brain to develop. That they help you learn. They help you make new connections within the brain. All right, so next time I'm going to start with astrocytes. So make sure I get all the... Where's there a sign-in sheet? Who's got a sign-in sheet? Is there another sign-in sheet anywhere? This is the only one? Ah, good. Here it is right here. Anybody need it? No. Oh, you did?
Yeah.
How? FADH2 is the